Good morning, everybody. Appreciate having this important gathering with our team about what will be no doubt a challenging environment at the federal level, and actually I think a pretty opportune one at the state level, in which we've got some important priorities that we already have in our heads, and we can make sure that that's clearly a shared agenda among the council, and where we're ready to go to work on trying to get some of that done. Just happened to come from a local public safety coordinating committee LIPSC meeting this morning, where we were talking about the mental health issue and the need for a psychiatric emergency facility. And so one of the topics on this list is already starting to get a lot of discussion among our partners. So looking forward to this conversation. Want to turn it over to our team. I think Martha's going to cue this up, and Vicki's going to talk about the federal level first, and we'll talk about the second legislative agenda in Salem second. So.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of council. For the record, Martha Pellegrino, Director of the Office of Government Relations. My team and I are pleased to be back with you today for the second of two work sessions. You may recall we met back in June to talk about some early concepts for both the state and federal legislative agendas, to recap what happened in the last sessions. And today we bring you the drafts of those concepts in the state that they are in now. So as the mayor said, in terms of today's format, we're going to give you some context of the political climate in Washington, D.C., and in Salem. And after the short presentation on the federal side, we'll be happy to take your questions. So before we begin, let me please introduce Vicki Cram, who is our representative in Washington, D.C., who came in for today's presentation. And to my right is Niels Tilstrom, who is the Senior Associate of Federal Affairs in my office. The three of us have been working together since August to solicit ideas and pieces of federal legislation that would be ripe and consistent with council's priorities. And we've been working with our legislative liaisons in each of the bureaus to refine those concepts. We've also been staying in touch with our congressional delegation on issues that they are leading on in this current year and things that they are planning to do in the upcoming year. So at this point, I'd like to turn things over to Vicki Cram to help give us a sense and perspective of what's happening in our nation's capital. Vicki.
Thank you. Thank you, Martha. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. So we had an election. I'm going to give you a brief overview of what's going on in the lame duck. And then 3,000-foot level. Yeah. And as you know, the Senate has changed hands and is now in Republican control. The number is 53 Republicans right now and 47 Democrats, or people who caucus with the Democrats like Bernie Sanders. Senator Landrieu is in a runoff race. Senator Landrieu is in a runoff race in Louisiana that will be determined this Saturday. It looks like she's going to lose, so it'll probably be 54 to 46 in the Senate. That's not 60. And it's not 67, which are the numbers you need for a filibuster and a veto override. So while it's changed hands, there's still going to have to be a lot of work with the Democrats. In the House, there was a pickup that was a little bit larger, I think, than people expected on the Republican side, so they picked up 12 seats. There are obviously changes in the Senate committee leadership, and most important to us is that Senator Ron Wyden will no longer be chair of the Senate Finance Committee. But Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah will be. They get along very well together. They work well together. They have worked well together over the past year. And this is really significant because tax reform is looming in the next Congress, as it has been in this Congress, but I think with a little bit more intention behind it. In the House, there have been some changes in committee leadership only because of retirements for people who have been defeated. But we have no chairs from Oregon, obviously, because most of our delegation is Democrats. We do have Congressman Greg Walden, who's in the leadership of the House. And Peter DeFazio has moved from being the ranking member on the Natural Resources Committee over to be the ranking member on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And that's of importance in this coming Congress because we have both the Surface Transportation Reauthorization, MAP 21, as well as the FAA reauthorization. So there are going to be two big bills that he will be the ranking minority member on. The leadership has pretty much stayed the same in the House and the Senate, except the Senate has just switched. So we have Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader and Harry Reid as Senate Minority Leader. We are now in a lame duck session of Congress. We have 2 weeks remaining. It started on November 12th, and virtually they did a lot of their organizational work the first couple of weeks before Thanksgiving, but virtually everything that they had on their plate when they started is still on their plate right now, which includes FY15 appropriations needing to be wrapped up, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is, I believe, going to the floor today or tomorrow in the House, tax extenders, tax provisions that need to be extended that have expired, the Internet Tax Freedom Act, which is the prohibition on state and local governments, except for those that are grandfathered in seven states, on being able for state and local governments to be able to impose Internet access taxes. There may be a push to make that permanent, or it may just be, it expires on December 11th, so it may just be renewed temporarily. The Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which we have been active on recently, and then some nominations, although it is, they're actually doing a number of ambassadorships today. The president's nominee, Loretta Lynch, for Eric Holder's job of attorney general will probably take place next year. It won't happen in the lame duck. And then, of course, immigration has happened on November 20th, and I'm going to talk a little bit more, very briefly, about some of this going on in the lame duck. In terms of the immigration reform, as we know, the president came out with his 3 points, and one is, of course, cracking down on the border and illegal immigration, but the other is deporting felons and not families, and allowing those undocumented immigrants who have lived here for more than 5 years and are parents of citizens or lawful permanent residents, if they comply, they don't have records, if they comply by paying their taxes, to be able to, in three-year increments, not be deported. So this action by the president has created a ripple effect with the FY15 appropriations bills that have been moving forward. The House passed 7, the Senate passed none, but they've been working on an omnibus bill, but now it looks like we're going to have what is called a cromnibus bill, which would be a hybrid of a continuing resolution and an omnibus appropriation. And so the idea would be that it's an animal that we've seen before, but it's never had a name before. And so this would allow perhaps the Department of Homeland Security to be on a continuing resolution for the first couple of months into the next year, and then the new Congress could take up whatever actions they want to take on the federal budget with regards to immigration. But the rest of the 11 appropriations bills would move forward in sort of a year-long fashion. Yes.
I think that we should now start referring to our federal legislative agenda as the cromnibus bill of the city of Portland.
I like that. So one of the things that we've been working very hard on specific to Portland in the omnibus appropriations bill for FY15, which is our current fiscal year, started October 1st, is the Urban Area Security Initiative funding. Which, as you all know, we rank number 26, and there have been attempts by Congress to impose caps that only the top 10 or the top 25 jurisdictions could be funded. In FY14, we fought really hard, got language included in the appropriations bill that allowed DHS the ability to look at all cities that might be at risk of terrorism or natural disaster to be funded, and they funded 39, and so we were funded. We got $1 million. It's not a lot of money, but it kept us going. In FY15, the current fiscal year that we are now battling over in the lame duck, the House has suggested only the top 10 areas get funded, which is New York, D.C., you can imagine. So we are fighting a battle on that to get the language, similar language to last year, or anyway, language that would allow us the ability to be funded by DHS. Another issue that we're working on are tax extenders. These are tax provisions that expire regularly and have some have expired in 2013, some have expired in 20, will expire at the end of this year. And they include the New Markets Tax Credit, they include empowerment zones, they include solar production tax credits, and wind energy tax credits. There was a big bill that was being proposed right before Thanksgiving. It imploded. We are now looking at a one-year extension, possibly, and they may bring that to the House floor as well shortly.
Was the big bill going to provide longer extensions?
It was going to provide some permanent extensions. So it was a $450 billion bill, so it was of concern to some people on the budget side of it. And from the administration's point of view, it didn't provide expansion of the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. And so the White House threatened to veto, and it all just fell apart. Bless you. The outlook for the 114th Congress is the FY16 appropriations process in which sequestration comes back to haunt us. We've had a two-year hiatus from sequestration, but it was only a two-year deal, and so there's a 7.9% potential domestic discretionary budget cut, unless Congress can figure out some way to avert that again. And so that is something that that we're going to be working on very, very hard. There's a 9% cut on military, and as you know, entitlement programs are exempt from sequestration. And I think we face the chance that we might have an even larger than 7.9% cut just because there will be a push to lower the impact on the military strategy side of the budget. And where do you make up the money? You make it up with us on city programs and domestic programs. So that's a real risk that we face, and we're going to have to be working very closely with that. We have Senator Merkley on the Senate Appropriations Committee, and, of course, he's been a great advocate for us. We have another opportunity, which are Tiger grants will come back again next year. We don't know what the overall funding level will be. This is all being determined in the cromnibus that we're working on now. But it'll be somewhere in the $500 to $100 million program. We're fighting very hard now to get language. The House has put a prohibition on bike and pedestrians projects being used in the Tiger program, so we're fighting very hard to get that language removed. But this is an opportunity for us to have been very successful with the Tiger grant program. We've had two. So there's another bite at the apple for a project that we might want to go after. MAP 21 reauthorization, the surface transportation reauthorization, Congressman DeFazio will be very key in this on the policy side, and of course Congressman Blumenauer and Senator Wyden on the tax side of this. We are going to be working on freight considerations are going to be a big part of this legislation. Reinstatement of bike and pedestrian transportation enhancements are something we're going to be working on. More local control we will try for, as well as highway safety provisions. Of course, the big issue facing any MAP 21 reauthorization is how do we fund it? The Highway Trust Fund is going broke, and there are a number of different ideas out there, increasing the gas tax, repatriation of taxes from overseas, vehicle miles traveled, et cetera. So they're all out there, but whether Congress will have the will to get behind a six-year substantive bill, which is about $85 to $100 billion, remains to be seen. I think Chairman Schuster on the transportation infrastructure on the House side is a very skilled legislator, and so he may well do it. But they may actually take the it expires at the end of May. They may actually take the Federal Aviation Administration bill first, which expires later, just because it's a little bit easier to do than MAP 21 and build the support for how you pay for transportation projects. Another large risk that we're facing is tax reform and what that looks like in terms particularly of a number of, it's going to be probably focused on business and small corporate and small business tax reform. Paul Ryan will be chair of the Ways and Means Committee next year. He's very dedicated to doing something. And I know that Senator Wyden has been very dedicated to looking at tax reform. But we have a number of tools in our toolbox that are essential to us, like the municipal bond exemption, low-income housing tax credit, new markets tax credit, which may all be on the table to be gutted or rolled back in some form in order to pay for lower taxes for corporations and small businesses. Another opportunity, and I think this one's a very good opportunity, is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act needs to be renewed next year, and I think the Republican, both chambers are very interested in doing something, and I think that the president is interested in signing something, and so I think this is an area where we really will see some movement, and we will be working on that, and we're going to talk about this when we get into the agenda part of it a little bit more depth. Another opportunity is the Ex-Im Bank, the Export-Import Bank, needs to be reauthorized at the end of June. And because of our export strategies and how dependent we are on exports and how we're a leader in exports as a municipality, this will be important for a lot of the businesses that we work with. As will the Trade Promotion Authority, which will, there's several different trade bills that may come up next year. So I just wanted to, in conclusion, I'm trying to keep this sort of high and quick so that I don't take up too much of your time, but we have a number of risks facing us. Congress sets funding levels. There may be environmental riders attached to funding bills. The development of the Surface Transportation Act and how it's funded, as well as a potential telecommunications rewrite, are things that we're going to be really working hard on because they're going to be real risks to our local preemption, well, funding sources and also preemption of our local authority. A lot of opportunities, I think, still, particularly with the administration, with some of the initiatives they have, like the My Brother's Keeper, which we are a part of, and, you know, sort of doing things that we're already doing and getting the administration as a part as a partner. And yesterday's announcement for the $263 million community policing initiative, which has $75 million set aside for body cameras. So we have a wonderful brand. We're known as sort of the perfect pilot project place where you can roll out something new, and you know that we're going to be innovative, and we're going to do it right, and we're going to get the right results. And I think that is something that we take with us wherever we go, and it's a great advantage. And thanks to all of you. Thank you.
Can you remind me why the Tiger Authority, or the Tiger program, comes back to life next year?
So the Tiger program has never been authorized, but it is appropriated every year. And so in the Senate bill, there's $550 million for a Tiger program. And for the first time ever, the House has put money in for Tiger at $100 million, a lower rate, in their appropriations bills. The House has language that prohibits Tiger funds being used for bike or pedestrian projects. And of course, a lot of the projects that we have had funded have, particularly the innovation quadrant, you know, it's a combination of everything, of every possible mode. So we're working to get that language removed, and maybe it will be. But there will be some funding for Tiger again.
Does Greg Walton not serve as a subcommittee chair because of his leadership position?
He is a subcommittee chair on the Energy and Commerce Committee and overseeing telecommunications.
Project or projects queued up, as far as we know, Steve?
I think we've got a couple of possibilities. Actually, ODOT was telling us that they thought that on Powell Division high capacity transit, it might be possible to take a whack at getting some Tiger funding for that, for example.
Given that we have projects like that that have pedestrian bike components, but would be eligible, right? I wonder whether we should continue to put a lot of effort into getting that ped bike thing out of there. If we got the Tiger funding for Powell, we could use other funding for something for ped bike.
Exactly.
Might be better use of whatever influence we have to get the money for a project that we can otherwise cover the other pieces of that.
Yes.
Okay.
So at this point, we'll go to the draft agenda that's in your packets on the federal side, and it is broken up into two sections. The first are the top-level priorities. There are currently seven of these, and it is in alphabetical order, just with a state agenda. Between now and January, we'll need to go through and find what are the city's priorities and put them in a relative order for the benefit of our delegation. So Niels and I will just kind of quickly touch on just the top-level priorities. If there's anything else you'd like to discuss, we're happy to do that. But Niels, why don't you get us started on education?
All right, thank you. So education, we've identified two items as priority items, a universal pre-kindergarten and college affordability. These are two concepts that could be zeroed in on the next Congress. Education is an opportunity for the 114th Congress to pass a bill that could be signed into law by the president, as Vicki was stating. With the early education, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act had expired in 2007, and Congress has failed to renew it. This provides us an opportunity to renew the bill, and also it's something that they're looking to take up first. And the agenda item is asks for the creation of a universal pre-K program, which is similar to what the president proposed in his 2014 proposed budget. The item that we have for the higher education for college affordability, the Higher Education Act expired in 2013, and all indications are that the renewal will look at modernizing loan programs, promoting financial literacy, and streamlining loan repayment programs. And these are items that we support broadly as policy items. So the next item we have as a priority is immigrants.
Where did that number come from? Nearly 3,760 children could be covered under the voluntary program for pre-K?
That came from an administration website.
Okay. So that's Oregon?
That's Oregon.
Seems low. Mm-hmm.
So immigration reform. So action taken by Congress on immigration reform in the short term looks to be tied to preventing the implementation of the president's executive order that he did in November. These actions probably will translate into little real comprehensive immigration reform down the road, unfortunately. The items in the draft reflect what we had in the 2014 federal legislative agenda, focusing on the need for a comprehensive strategy that creates a path for citizenship, a guest worker program that can address the diverse needs of our economy. And additionally, we have included the opposition to the SAFE Act, which would require local law enforcement to engage in immigration enforcement activities at the risk of losing federal funding.
That's a good question, and perhaps Commissioner Fritz also knows the answer to this. How much of the DREAM Act is picked up by the president in his executive order? Because the council a few years ago took a very strong position supporting the DREAM Act. And is a portion of it picked up in what he did?
A very slight portion of the DREAM Act is picked up under the DACA, The administration was very careful to make sure that whatever they did, they could justify legally because they knew it was going to be challenged legally. So it was actually, I think, a more narrower executive order than some people anticipated it being. And a lot of people thought the Dreamers would be included in it, and they haven't been as much as originally was thought.
And that's why we recognize the work that was done through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which is the DACA executive order, but we still ask for the passage of the DREAM Act. And then the next item we have is the increase in the federal minimum wage. The federal minimum wage stands at $7.25 an hour. It was last raised in July 2009. The Oregon's minimum wage is $9.10 an hour, and states across the country vary, with Washington being the highest at $9.32. This is an issue for economic security for millions of Americans.
So I'll take over here with touching on the next few. Portland Harbor Superfund. The cleanup of the Portland Harbor continues to be a very high priority for the city. In this last year, EPA dedicated some additional resources from Washington, D.C. to Region 10 to help with the work leading up to the cleanup plan. In addition, the city also supports Representative Blumenauer's work to reauthorize the Superfund tax. Next item is municipal bonds. This is probably the least sexy sounding item in our federal legislative agenda, and yet it is very critical to all of the things that we build. Transportation infrastructure, water and sewer, building schools, building fire stations, police stations. It's the financing mechanism by which governments build things, and it has been under threat by both the administration and Congress. Vicki mentioned it's been part of the conversation of tax reform. City of Portland was one of the first cities in the country to take a strong position on this, and we do still have a member of our delegation in a position to impact how that particular financing mechanism is part of tax reform. We also have LT2.
This is a complicated subject, but it's, I think, worth putting in very stark terms for us. Currently, we are bound by a number of federal mandates which require us locally to spend a fortune, probably $2 billion if you just look at our water and sewer infrastructure in the last 20 years. And so that's the hand we've been dealt. The changes that are being proposed to cap the amount of interest which would be deductible on tax-free municipal bonds would simply have the effect of changing the market and raising the costs of seeking tax-free debt. So the irony here is as we continue to have to locally fund federal mandates, which we're willing to do, we would be thinking at the federal level of changing the rules to drive up our borrowing costs to cover our costs of complying with federal mandates. And frankly, the argument you often hear is that there's something, some people just don't like tax-free municipal debt, don't like who principally buys it and benefits from it and the like. Those are good questions to debate, but there's a certain, in my mind, an academic quality, which is, well, then what's the alternative you think is a fairer way to generate the same kind of flexible resources for state and local jurisdictions? Because ultimately, we have to borrow to cover these costs. But there's a real risk here if there are fundamental changes in the tax-free municipal bond market. The significant risk to us is it will drive our cost of borrowing up dramatically. And that's why it matters to ratepayers and to people locally.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then we have LT2. This is has been a perennial item in our legislative agenda. This piece is really about tracking EPA's periodic review process in a way that helps us defend the variance the city works so hard to achieve. And basically, we will monitor any activity in Washington, D.C. that impacts how the city delivers our drinking water system.
And again, this is a very complicated issue, but Commissioner Fritz and I the other day had a chance to talk about this in Mount Tabor. We are the only city in America to obtain a variance from this side of the LT2 rule, which requires us to treat our water for cryptosporidium. And the concern we have is that if the regulations change and somehow make our current testing regime out of compliance, we could end up through the back door having to revisit the question of a treatment plant or some other huge local investment. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do at the federal level is protect or make sure we have influence over the rules that govern our compliance, our method of compliance. And we're hoping that they don't just redefine the ground rules, which put us out of compliance, because then we'll have to come back to the question of whether we have to spend $100 million on a UV filtration plant or some other alternative.
And Commissioner, hopefully still have the ability to use tax-exempt municipal bonds to build that treatment facility if we had to build one.
And then, Niels, why don't you touch on the last piece, and we'll go to questions.
Absolutely. So the last piece we have is transportation funding, and as Vicki alluded to, the way the federal government raises funds for transportation projects is failing. The federal gas tax has not been raised since 1993, and it's buying less, things cost more, and people are driving less and more efficient cars when they do drive. It reached a critical moment this summer where it came perilously close to insolvency, and through creative, I think that's the way we should phrase it, creative measures, Congress was able to plug the hole until end of May 2015. To address the underlying issue, the city is advocating for two solutions. First is a 15-cent increase in the federal gas tax indexed to inflation. And the second is a federal road user fee program and pilot programs to allow states more flexibility to do their own user fee programs. Additionally, the city is supporting increased funding for the Small Starts program for bus and light rail transit investment, as well as an increased allocation to the Tiger program to allow for that infrastructure investment that's targeted to economic development.
So that's the quick overview. Happy at this point to answer any questions you have about what we've covered in the agenda or the other pieces that are in the draft.
So I'm wondering why the earned sick time doesn't, I see it in the policies, but it's not on the priorities, and I'm wondering why that is.
First of all, we were looking for a limited number of proposed priorities. At this point, council can put anything you like on that priority list. I think with that particular item, the likelihood of it coming up in any substantial way at the federal level is substantially diminished because of the elections dynamics we're talking about. However, at the state level, and we'll get to that, we think there are actually very positive prospects. And so it's more of a try to tailor some of the priorities toward things that we believe are somewhat achievable, and yet ultimately it's council's decision what you want to have as top line items.
Given that, and given that we are a leader in the nation on it, it seems like it wouldn't hurt to put it on the priorities if you're not going to have to spend much time on it anyway, but to have it on the list as a highlighted thing that we believe is important and might tee it up for a future legislature with the Congress that might be more favorable.
And this, Commissioner, this is an issue that the White House has been very interested in, and I'm not sure where they're going with it, but there may be some activity administratively as well.
Letting them know that we're right there with them.
Exactly.
The flip side question, which is that given, you know, there's this long list of other issues which may or may not have legs in this Congress, given the shift of leadership, do you think there's some of these that have more potential than we used to think they would have? I mean, you know, are there some of these that are more likely to move now because of, I'm not just mean the negative things like the SAFE Act, but positive things that we might have a stake in. I mean, for example, we've been real successful with the VASH vouchers, and there's a real emphasis in the administration on housing veterans. Are we likely to see a Republican-controlled Congress really want to get behind our veterans and do more for VASH vouchers? So I'm just trying to surf the change here and wondering if there's some of the stuff in the rest of the list that actually is more likely to move forward than, say, 15-cent gas tax, as much as that makes sense, and Congressman Rubenauer has been advocating for it for some time. You know, I think all of us will be surprised if Congress bestirs itself and actually does that. You see where I'm headed here. Mm-hmm. So would you raise the prospects of some of these other items given the change in the politics?
Mayor, I think that's an interesting way to look at this, and I think the HUD VASH vouchers is one that actually probably you've probably hit the nail on the head. I think a number of the ones that we have in our draft priority list are going to see action in some form or another. Mm-hmm. But we can do another scrub of this and try and pull out some of the issues that we think might, under the changed New World Order,
Trying to look around the corner a little bit here. I mean, if
exactly.
The President and Congress are going to just sort of eye each other warily on immigration but not do much, okay. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at that outcome. But if they're actually going to keep trying to find things that they agree on, and one of them might be, quote-unquote, taking care of our veterans, we might have a stake in that issue given what we've accomplished so far with VASH vouchers and in our interest in doing more. So I picked that one out for that reason, just speculating that might be one of those areas where between the administration really emphasizing that and this Congress being pro-defense, I would assume, maybe there's some there.
And I second what the mayor is saying, and particularly because I understand, Vicki, you told us once that the only agency that's actually exempt from sequestration is the VA.
Correct.
Another program that's actually done well under Republican-controlled Congresses is the COPS program. And
right.
Portland has received a couple of different grants, one grant, a micro grant on equity training, and another grant on community-oriented policing. So I think that may be another area where we see as much opportunity as we have under the current Congress.
All right, and this body cams funding that they've set aside, we've obviously already appropriated some money ourselves for that, but not enough to do everything we need to do, but we're in a great position to say, yeah, we can match federal grant requirements easily with what we were able to commit locally to that, and it's something that we want to do. We need state legislation, and we'll get to that, to be able to use the equipment, but nevertheless, if there's a federal interest in helping to pay for it, we may be in a good position there.
Right.
What about the oil train response, oil train safety and response? Is that sort of in that same category of something that's a bipartisan appeal and a growing problem everywhere, or problem is the right word?
Yeah, what do you think about that?
I think that's actually another good one, Commissioner. I think you're right that we can see some action on.
Yeah, I don't know, Vicki, if you follow the local conversation here, but we asked our fire chief, you know, are we ready to deal with an oil train fire? And she answered no. And we, of course, have no regulatory authority over the railroads, but if there were federal funds available to help local fire agencies be prepared for fighting an oil train fire, or, you know, again, working with the railroads but not necessarily depending entirely on them, that may be another area where, you know, we are in a position to be able to step up and meet federal requirements, but mm-hmm. more federal help would help pay the bills, because yeah. we need equipment and training and, you know, well, those two things particularly. We have the personnel, we need the equipment and the training.
And also, just to the extent they improve the safety standards for the new tanks, those, a lot of those new tanks are mm-hmm. being made by Greenbrier.
Yeah. Other questions, comments, guidance?
Couple of things. One is that I realize that there's not anything our delegation can do that they're not already doing, probably, and it's mostly a matter of supporting the president. But I wouldn't feel good about not including climate change in our priorities, because it is the greatest challenge humankind has ever faced. I mean, in the New York Times the other day noted that scientists warn that it now may be impossible to prevent the temperature of the planet's atmosphere from rising by 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. According to a large body of scientific research, that is the tipping point at which the world will be locked into a near-term future of drought, food and water shortages, melting ice sheets, shrinking glaciers, rising sea levels, and widespread flooding. Another factor is that the estimates are that between 20 and 50% of the Earth's species will be at risk of extinction. So that doesn't mean that every item under our climate change agenda, I don't think, should be moved up to a priority. But a statement about climate change, and perhaps specifically highlighting supporting the president's power plant efforts, I think it would be appropriate as a statement of principle to elevate that to the priority level. So that's...
What do people think about that?
I agree with that. I think that's a good point.
A couple of... other items. We had a healthcare section, I believe, in last year's agenda, which I'd like to renew. A couple of specific things. One, we had talked about asking Congress to explore reimbursing firefighters for the medical work that they do. So I'd like to work with Commissioner Saltzman on some language to renew that request, that instead of Medicare only reimbursing ambulances for taking people to emergency rooms, they should come up with a way to, in some way, reimburse everybody involved in medical response. I mean, as you know, most of the firefighters' calls now are medical calls, and we don't get any reimbursement from insurance. And another healthcare item that I'd be interested in adding back in is, and I realize this has no prospect in a Republican Congress that is not going to do anything to improve the ACA, but there is that ACA provision that defines affordability of coverage for families in a really irrational way. So I wouldn't mind having that restored. And another thing is, we asked, in various ways, we're asking the federal government for money. And I think it would behoove us to identify some ways in which the federal government could get more money. And something I think worth putting into the list is supporting efforts to limit the ability of international corporations to avoid taxes by shifting their income overseas in various artificial ways. I mean, inversions where companies merge with foreign companies in order solely to avoid taxes is the sort of something that's been on the front burner recently. But going back way before that, I mean, many international corporations engage in practices which artificially shift their incomes to tax havens. And both Senator Levin and Senator Sanders have proposed steps to address that. So mm-hmm. I'd like us to be on record as supporting those efforts. And actually, given that there's some people in Congress talking about funding transportation by giving corporations a tax holiday to, quote, bring their money home and be taxed at an extraordinarily low rate, which is horrible tax policy, as was demonstrated in 2004 when they did the same thing and Pfizer used the money to buy back stock. I think that having statements about positive ways to increase revenue would be useful.
Other federal topics we ought to cover before we switch our view to Salem here? Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay.
Vicki, just in concept, what's the value of having commissioners come to Washington and do the circuit with you? I mean, in recent vintage, we would do the circuit with you and meet with committee chairs or ranking members of committee. But now it's going to be a different environment. So how has the change in the control of the Congress changed at all your view of the value of having commissioners come and spend a couple of days with you in Washington?
I think there's a lot of value in that. And one is to the mayor's point of finding places where we do have commonality with the leadership in the Senate and the House and being able to educate them on what we're doing and our approach, and finding out where we can work together with them, And the other is it's very, very useful to be able to go and meet with the federal agencies prior to grants being announced. Once a grant is announced, you're not allowed to lobby the federal government. Your delegation can send letters, but you can't. And so prior to the grants announcements, it's really helpful for us to just go and meet and touch base with HUD, with the Department of Transportation, with the VA, with whomever is our particular, your interest and our interest at the time, to just lay the groundwork, let them know what we're doing. Because then when a grant does come down the pike and we put in an application, they have all this background. They already know about it, and they recognize it when it comes in and go, you know, that's a really great program. Maybe we should fund that. So I think those are very, very helpful ways that you can advance the city's agenda by coming to Washington. And thank you for all of you who do, because I know it's not easy, but it's appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to go through our costume change from the federal to the state agenda. So I'd like to invite up the state team. And to my left is Andy Smith, the manager of state government relations. To my right is Elizabeth Edwards, our senior associate. And the newest member of our team, Ariel Nelson, who's going to help us also help us out on the state team. One thing I failed to mention for our viewers at home, assuming there are any, we actually will have the drafts that council's going through posted to our website later today. And you can access the website for the Office of Government Relations by going to www.portlandoregon.gov/OGR. And again, later today, we'll have these drafts available for the greater public. So just a couple of words about when we started to do this process, and you'll remember this from when we met in June for our work session. We started building the 2015 state legislative agenda almost immediately after the conclusion of the February session. And we've been working with each of the bureaus and offices since then to develop and vet issues that are ripe for introduction. And we've also been in the process of conducting some pretty extensive outreach to governmental, nonprofit, and business groups, as well as to our legislative delegation, both sort of the metro area and to other parts of the state. So with that, we have a brief PowerPoint presentation for you. And I just want to kick things off by thanking each of the legislative liaisons in the bureaus and in your offices. A great deal of work has gone into getting us to this point. I also want to make one brief plug. On December 15th, we are going to be doing, I think, our fifth Advocacy 101 training session for the community. This is something we started, Commissioner Fritz encouraged us to develop a 101 for the community on how to be an effective advocate in Salem. I think we have an all-star panel for the public, and that includes Senator Michael Dembro, Representative Jennifer Williamson. We have Grace Neal from Senator Wyden's office, and we have Felisa Haggins from SEIU. So we pretty much, I think we've got the all-star panel, so if people are interested in coming, more information is on ONI's website, but it's the evening of December 15th, and we look forward to seeing a great and active group at that time. So I'm going to turn things over to Elizabeth, who's going to take us through the first part of our PowerPoint presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Martha. For the record, Elizabeth Edwards, Senior Associate with Office of Government Relations on the state side. Want to direct your attention to this second slide here, timeline for the 2015 session, and just highlight a few dates to keep in mind. Next week, we have legislative days in Salem. Interim committees will meet for 3 days and discuss items that might come up in the 2015 session. Then in early January, we'll come back before you and hopefully have our agendas adopted. And even though the legislative session doesn't begin until February 2nd, notably Groundhog Day, there will be organizational days in mid-January where new members will be sworn in and committees will meet.
If the legislature sees its shadow, does that mean that it recesses for another 6 weeks?
If only. So turning over to the next slide, quick snapshot of the state's leadership. It's been unchanged since last session, and I have two Portland members sort of leading the helm, House Speaker Tina Kotek and Majority Leader Senator Dianne Rosenbaum. And in terms of the balance of power, Oregon really bucked the national trend. Democrats gained seats in both chambers. Just a quick reminder that there's a three-fifths vote threshold for any revenue-raising measures. On the Senate side, Democrats have a supermajority, 18 Democrats to 12 Republicans. On the House side, they're one vote short. You have 35 Democrats to 25 Republicans. And then I would... That's correct. And we also have a lot of new members coming in. Almost a full third of the Oregon House will be new. In the Portland area, we have three new members of our delegation, Representative-elect Kathleen Taylor, who will be taking over for retired member Representative Carolyn Tomei. We have Representative-elect Ken Helm, who will be taking over for Representative Chris Harker, and Representative-elect Carla Peluso, who will be stepping into Representative Greg Matthews' shoes. And many of these members have small portions of Portland in their districts. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Andy for a quick overview of the state's budget climate.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I'm Andy Smith, State Government Relations Manager. So the governor's recommended budget came out yesterday, and it's an indication of the governor's legislative priorities, and it serves as a starting point for budget considerations, which may actually get underway a little earlier than expected, with a co-chair's budget possibly released as early as January. And although we're still working through the governor's budget, we've identified several items in his budget that align with items in our legislative agenda. And for example, the governor's budget calls for investments in homelessness and housing, brownfield cleanup, community mental health, transportation, and education. And moving on to the next slide, other budget considerations for this upcoming session. The legislature is still in its current budget cycle, the 13-15 biennium, and the last revenue forecast in November had revenues holding relatively steady. State economists are now projecting that the corporate income tax kicker will kick, and that will send about $52.2 million to K-12 education pursuant to Measure 85. The personal income tax kicker will depend on April tax payments, and the budget environment would be significantly impacted if the personal income tax kicker threshold is met, which could result in a revenue shortfall between $300 and $500 million. Even though the state... And even though the state has significantly more revenue at its disposal due to improved economic conditions than it had going into the current budget cycle, costs have also increased, and we do expect a very competitive budget environment where the legislature is still going to be faced with very tough choices.
So I wonder if the legislature could consider a version of Measure 85 for the personal kicker. Are they thinking about that with our supermajorities, or at least majorities?
So I know that several legislators are interested in looking at things like a rainy day fund for kicker proceeds, but I don't know if I don't think that's something that is going to be front and center on the table for this next legislative session.
Well, it seems like it should be, because, you know, when you look at, and I was looking at the first bullet of corporate income tax, I'm like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. And then I'm thinking, because of Measure 85, it goes to K-12 education. That makes sense. And you get to the personal kicker, and it you know, a $29 million variance, which is a smidgen of the state's budget, potentially causing a $500 million deficit, that doesn't make any sense. And it would seem like the voters of Argonne would approve something in a heartbeat if it made sense.
And I fully expect that, as Andy has described, this piece will cast a shadow through about the middle part of session when they're trying to figure out how much money do they actually have to spend. So I would expect to see both of the revenue chairs in the House and the Senate to be taking up the issue and talking about what are some options. So I do see there to be discussion about whether anyone has the appetite to take on the personal kicker.
I know that some years ago there was some talk about limiting the personal kicker to like the amount that somebody in the 70th percentile of income gets. Because, I mean, one feature of a progressive tax system plus spectacular income inequality is that the richest 10% might wind up getting the lion's share of the kicker. So one reform people talked about before was, say, the kicker is capped at X, and X is something that is more than most people get. Has there been any discussion of that in the legislature in recent years?
It's been a couple sessions since they've talked about the kicker. And the only reason they're talking about it now is it looks like it's going to kick. So I think with the new body we have and the Democrats picking up more seats, I think it's something that they're going to take up and trying to figure out, is it something that happens near term, or is it longer term plan for more structural stability? This is obviously one of the greatest instabilities of our state revenue structure. So I expect to see more discussions about it, but I think trying to make it more progressive in nature will be part of that discussion.
Okay, moving on to the next slide, which is the likely issues in the 2015 legislative session. The list is in front of you, and I won't go through the list, but this slide does highlight some of the issues that we do expect to be front and center in the legislature in this upcoming session. And I think that we'll know a lot more about this list when legislative leadership releases their priorities over the next month or so.
So what we're going to do now is turn to the... Oh, sure.
I just had a question about inclusionary zoning on the likely issues. Is there... I mean, I know Speaker Kotek had a work group that didn't really arrive at any kind of recommendations. Are we expecting a greater push to establish inclusionary zoning, or and who are the lead advocates in the legislature on that?
Martha, I have some new information on that, too.
So elements of that work group that have been pushing for inclusionary zoning to be a part of the conversation have, I think, continue to push for it, and with the results of the election producing what looks like to be a much more favorable environment, a coalition has grown around those advocates that includes unions, housing advocates, to push for lifting the preemption.
Is there a legislator or two that have sort of emerged as maybe likely to be active on that?
There's been several legislators that have been very interested in that here in the Portland delegation. Representative Kenny Geyer has been very interested in it. Representative Reardon, who was one of the co-chairs of the housing work group, has historically been very interested in it. And I think you're seeing interest from others like Representative Williamson as well.
And so here's what I've heard. When the governor was campaigning for re-election, he was asked at the City Club this issue, and he said he favored lifting the preemption. So he's on record. And my understanding is that the House Speaker favors an approach which would just be a clean bill that simply lifts the preemption and allows each local jurisdiction to sort it out for themselves. And my understanding is that that's what the leadership will end up pushing.
And that's consistent with what we're hearing as well. So at this point, we actually have an opportunity to touch on the high-level items in the draft state legislative agenda in your packet. And this agenda is actually split up into three pieces, and it's the top-level priorities, again, in alphabetical order. The initiatives, these are the bills where the city will take the lead on introducing and moving through the legislative process. And then the policy positions, which are those items where the city will take a position on before session, either support or oppose, and assist partners in moving those through the legislative process. Why don't we go ahead and just touch on, have Andy and Elizabeth touch on the priorities and initiatives, and then we'll take questions.
So at the top of the list is brownfield cleanup. Portland has been working as part of a larger coalition to address the redevelopment of brownfield sites. As you know, brownfield sites come in various sizes and conditions, and so this coalition is looking at multiple tools to address the issue, namely recapitalization of the brownfield redevelopment fund at Business Oregon, a statewide tax credit, and some local jurisdictional tools like land banking authority and tax abatement.
Modest amount into his proposed budget for recapitalization, $7 million, right?
That's correct.
But what we think it needs is 30 to 50, is that?
The coalition initially requested $50 million, knowing that the full $50 million wasn't likely to be awarded. But we can still do good work with the $7 million.
But it limits the size of projects that can be
absolutely
done, right? So we really, this is an issue for us. If we really want it to work, it probably needs more than $7 million.
That's correct.
If it remains a high priority for us, that's sort of a go big or go home mm-hmm. proposition.
Well, the city's share of $7 million, given the fact that we also have to match it with EPA grants and other kinds of funding, means we could probably do a quarter of what we did in St. John's, which mm-hmm. took 10 years. So
yeah.
It's a nice start, but it doesn't get us very much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
All right, turning to the next item on the priority list, earned sick leave. We are hearing that there is increasing interest among members in an effort to pass a statewide earned sick leave policy. And this item signals support for a statewide policy that doesn't interfere with Portland's enacted earned sick leave ordinance. The next item on the list is gun safety.
When you say it doesn't impact, you're saying that you're hearing that the legislature might seek to have a statewide rule without a preemption?
Without a preemption or without without a lower standard than is under our ordinance here in Portland.
And I think I just want to clarify the question. I mean, I think we haven't seen any draft legislation at this point, so I think it's actually a little early to tell. The no preemption will be front and center in our advocacy, but we have not seen where they want to land at this point, but I think we at least it's an issue we want to flag up front.
But just politically, I understand our position, I support it, but isn't what brings critics to the table the idea that it's a uniform rule, and so doesn't preemption then become a very significant part of this debate?
I think it can be. The most recent, what I would call big preemption fights in Salem, GMO being among them. There was a grandfathering in of early adopters, and so a question is going to be whether that's an approach that leadership wants to take or if they want to pass a statewide policy that's close enough to what Portland has done, in which case we would bring that back to council and see what you all would like to do with that.
Okay, turning to gun safety. This item has been a City of Portland priority for the last three legislative sessions, and we are hearing that there is significant legislative momentum building to address closing the background check loophole for the private purchase of firearms. On homelessness and housing, this has also been a consistent priority for the City of Portland. In the 2014 legislative session, the legislature made a one-time allocation to bring the emergency housing account and the state homeless assistance program back to pre-recession levels, and this item signals continued support for investments in those critical safety net programs.
The governor's proposed $100 million investment, not a lot of specifics yet.
Right.
A big earmark.
$15 million in lottery money, $85 million in bond proceeds, and a lot of questions about how you get there.
Okay, moving on.
I guess just before we leave gun safety, I've heard of an effort being mounted to better protect survivors of domestic violence who have restraining orders issued against somebody with a gun in terms of more uniform gun dispossession requirements at the state level? Is that something that could be we could ally ourselves with, too, if it is in fact happening?
Yes, it is. And I think that we worded our gun priority in a way where we could be active on gun safety measures that this body approves of that are on the table in Salem. There is a group working on a proposal of that nature.